Support for NPR podcasts comes from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting the Irish rock film Once on DVD Tuesday.
This podcast is a production of KCRW and KCRW.com Santa Monica. If you enjoy this program, check out KCRW.com for more than 20 additional programs that you can podcast.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, the writer's strike goes on and on. And so we wondered, what's it like to actually negotiate during a strike? We talk with the man who spoke for almost 60,000 employees during the acrimonious 2004 supermarket walkout. Plus, will the writer's strike put another nail in the coffin of the once wildly profitable daytime soap opera? But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Don't go anywhere. It's The Business from NPR. Striking screenwriters' already fragile egos suffered another devastating blow last week. A UCLA economist announced that the off-sided $1 billion damage estimate from a protracted writer's strike is greatly exaggerated. Jerry Nicholsberg, an economist with UCLA's Anderson School of Management, released a report showing a five-month or longer work stoppage would hit Southern California with $300 million in economic fallout, substantially less than the $1 billion recently calculated by Los Angeles County's Economic Development Corporation. In related news that might assuage writers' battered self-images, WGA members have taken 19 of the 50 slots on Entertainment Weekly's first-ever Smart List. Writes my old pal Sean Smith, power lists are so over. Smith, of course, famously caused all sorts of ulcers throughout show business while West Coast editor of Premier magazine. The now-defunct Premier, of course, created the original Hollywood power list. No matter, last week Smith wrote that while power tells you who's in charge, it doesn't tell you who's shaking things up. EW, of course, isn't completely insane. It decided to go in search of Hollywood's smartest, but also offered this sop to those whose publicists couldn't get them on the smart list. Quote, at 50 names, the list could not possibly include every smart person in Hollywood. Meanwhile, in the record business, which has proven to be lacking even 25 people of average intelligence, it's become a battle of two TV heavyweights on the Billboard charts. After weeks of promotion culminating with Oprah Winfrey's cultural imprimatur, Josh Groban's holiday-themed album Noel has topped the Billboard 200. According to the latest SoundScan tallies, sales of Noel spiked by 81% following Groban's appearance last week on Oprah. The disc had initially debuted at number 10 the week after its release, scanning just 64,000 copies. But if Oprah's still got it, another TV powerhouse is showing signs of age. American Idol's sixth winner, Jordan Sparks, saw her self-titled album debut with the lowest first-week numbers of any previous Idol champ. Finally, a legal spat involving the man who sang Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer could wind up in court just in time for Christmas. The song, crooned by one-hit wonder Elmo Shropshire, first began peeling the enamel off our teeth in 1979 and even inspired an animated TV show that appeared in 2000. The Fred Rappaport Company of California contends it has the rights to use the holiday novelty tune for products featuring characters from the TV show. Rappaport sued Shropshire for breach of contract last week for allegedly interfering in a $1 million-plus deal to sell Grandma musical bobblehead dolls, snow globes, and cookie jars. Shropshire contends he was trying to stop the deal to enforce his rights to the song. Rappaport, quote, can sell any characters he wants from the movie, Shropshire told USA Today. But I own the copyright from the song. He can't use the song without my permission.
Grandma got run over by a reindeer.
Yo, Grand Mizzle, duck the reindeer.
Walking home from our house Christmas Eve.
Swaying on the side, she should have pimped a ride.
You can say there's no such thing as Santa.
Pretend he can fly.
But as for me and Grandpa, we believe.
And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later, soap operas, daytime's venerable shows, become vulnerable. But next, what's really going on inside a strike negotiation?
Footprints on her hooters and bruises on her booty.
The Hollywood writer's strike is, in the end, all about money, as all strikes are. Yet 99% of all labor talks end in labor management peace, not pickets. When they don't, it can be more than just money that stands in the way. Labor negotiations are highly emotional and are as susceptible to personalities as to principles. We got to wondering about what it's like to actually try to work out differences between two parties at an impasse, especially after weeks of acrimonious talks and with a strike underway. So our producer Matt Holtzman gave a call to a man who would know. Among Steve Stemmerman's other credits, he represented almost 60,000 striking Southern California supermarket workers in their 2004 walkout.
Steve Stemmerman, thanks for joining us on The Business.
You're quite welcome. Glad to be here.
So are there negotiations about the negotiations? I mean, is there back and forth about who's going to sit where and when they're going to break for food and all that kind of stuff?
All of the above. You can literally argue over the shape of the table. What is most common is arguing where you meet. The tendency, obviously, is to find, quote, neutral locations.
A hotel room, a hotel conference room?
Hotel conference room or a series of rooms, breakout rooms, et cetera. Whether you meet in one person's entity's breakout room or another, or if you basically have your breakout room, the other side has their breakout room, and then there's a neutral third room that they meet in when both sides get together.
There isn't a seating chart?
There's no seating chart. What you do is, basically, it's got to be set up so you face each other. Sometimes, just to mix things up, I will sit not in the exact middle. I'll sit off to the side just to kind of break, you know, whatever pattern has been held there to signal that, you know, we're trying to change something. There's all sorts of the interesting thing about negotiations, especially when you're negotiating with someone else who is very experienced, is there's all sorts of subtle and not so subtle signals you send to each other.
Right. Like if somebody makes an offer and you grimace at that offer, that tells everybody, oh, wow, I think I should have gone higher on that one because he's not taking that.
Well, it's not the fact you say no. It's how you say no.
For example,
there's no and then there's hell no. and there's no that really means maybe, or there's a no that means if you did X, Y, and Z, maybe it'll be a yes. But you don't want to say that, so there's all sorts of more subtle ways to get the message across. And if it works, great. If they pick up your signal and react the way you want them to, great. And if they don't, well, I never said that. That wasn't what I was asking for. Hmm. So, you know, you always tentatively get a toe out on the limb, and if it doesn't break off, you maybe get a few more toes. And so you don't want to get too far out there where someone else could break the limb out from under you.
Do you know the personality of the people that you're going to be across the table from so that you can use the techniques that work best with that person?
Personally, I do. And I tend to negotiate with people over and over again so we both understand and learn our styles. And my style is not bombastic. I don't try to put on a show for my clients. I try to be as truthful and honest as I can, try to get that same in return from the other side. And the best way I can do that is by being as straightforward and honest as possible and gaining the other side's trust.
But are there times when you just know we're going to have to play this a certain way? We're going to have to play good cop, bad cop. We're going to have to do, you know, whatever because this guy's intractable or because he's a problematic personality?
Oh, of course. You never go into negotiations without assessing not only the issues, but who you're dealing with, who will be espousing those issues for the other side. And you come up with a strategy. You could take preemptive strategies in the way you formulate your proposals. You could do the good cop, bad cop routine. You could use publicity with the public or certain segments of the public to put pressure on the other side even before you get to the bargaining table.
So how does that work? I mean, do outside factors like the press and public opinion and other outside forces, do they really have an effect on what goes on in the negotiating room?
It depends on the industry. And that if you're talking about dealing with an industry that's dependent upon the public goodwill, yes, that could be critical.
But I'm thinking, in fact, of the supermarket strike in 2004 in Southern California. Would the fact that people are speaking, you know, that you're ruining your reputation with your potential customers, your past and potential customers, and this is what we're hearing on the street, they're saying, I'm never going to shop at XYZ again because of this. Would you bring that up in the room?
Of course, but that's almost a given. You know, one interesting thing, in those kind of disputes, when you get into bargaining between management and unions, it's almost always an uneven situation. The employer doesn't mind, in some cases would prefer, if the union went away, if they destroyed the union. There's never going to be a case where a union is sitting down bargaining with an employer where they want to destroy that employer, because by destroying that employer, they're destroying the jobs and the livelihoods of the people that they're representing. So you always go into negotiations with a very different level in terms of the mass destruction quotient. The employers can try to kill you. You don't try to kill the employer. You're always got at least one, if not two, hands tied behind your back. The Southern California grocery strike is a good example of that. You want the support of the public, but you don't want to be so effective that they never come back even after the strike is over.
There are also reasons that a business might want a strike in order to bring in lower wage workers, and there are benefits to them to having a strike, in some cases, a short strike at least.
Most of the situations, and fortunately I haven't been involved in many, but most of the situations where there's a strike, it really is one that the employer has fostered or created, a situation where they knew a strike was going to be inevitable for the reasons you mentioned, that they know they can't accomplish certain things without a strike, as strange as that might sound.
If you're just joining us, apropos of the writer's strike and the very real possibility of an actor's strike next summer, the business producer Matt Holzman is talking to labor lawyer Steve Stemmerman about the politics of strike negotiation. Stemmerman represented almost 60,000 striking Southern California supermarket workers in their 2004 walkout.
All right, so let's go back to the beginning a little bit, and if I may ask you, you know, you were the lead negotiator for the UFCW in 2004, representing tens of thousands of Southern California supermarket workers during their strike, or leading up to the strike, and I'm guessing after the strike as well. How did you decide, let's say after the strike had started, how did you get back in the room? Who called who, and how did you decide where you're going to go and how that was all going to go down?
Well, at that point, there was a federal mediator. A matter of fact, the head of the Federal Mediation Service actually came out from Washington, D.C.
And you had both decided you needed a mediator, or?
Well, yes and no. A mediator often facilitates communication between the parties. In our case, as I told the mediator, we're not having a trouble communicating. We just don't like what each other is saying. In that case, though, the mediator did serve purpose because the mediator could call the parties together. When you're on strike, the last thing you want is to show weakness. So you don't want to be the one who asks to get back to the bargaining table, because that shows that, uh-oh, maybe you're willing to move now. Maybe you're going to be going backwards.
Hmm.
What a mediator can do is call for the meeting. Now, what happens, and I'm not saying it happened in the Southern California situation, but what often happens is one side or the other will call the mediator and ask the mediator to set a meeting. So it looks like a neutral party is asking for the meeting, when in fact one of the parties actually wants to get back to the bargaining table.
Hmm. When you're sitting around the table with, you know, the head of, you know, you've got seven heads of local unions.
Mm-hmm.
These are not the quiet retiring type of people. Do you have a signal that, you know, you take your finger across your throat and say, shut up now, like, you know, stop, you know, you're going down the wrong path? Or how do you kind of keep everybody in step as you're going through the process of everyone sitting at the table?
Well, that's why you do try to have a single spokesperson, so you speak with one voice.
I see. So they're at the table, but they're actually letting you do the talking.
For the most part. And that works on both sides, same with the employers.
And do you do this, the senator, excuse me, senator, and hold your hand over the microphone and talk to them as an aside, or is it other times when you just have to break back into the caucus room to discuss a point?
Yeah, it's very typical, but that's the fact of the matter is negotiations typically have many, many caucus breaks for that very reason.
In the supermarket strike again, do you remember after the strike had began and at some point people sat back down at the table, what was the first thing that the first person said?
I wish I could tell you, but and I obviously it was not dramatic enough for me to remember.
Well, that's an answer in and of itself. It wasn't a movie moment anyway.
No, it was that was a very difficult situation. The parties were extremely far apart on very important issues, and we had that went on 20 weeks, and there were a series of negotiations. I'm not telling you we negotiated every week or every day, but we had many negotiation sessions where the parties, I think, attempted, using their best efforts, to try to find solutions. It took us a long time.
It does seem, though, when you hear about the fact that people aren't negotiating, that they aren't in the room, you know, if you've got brothers and sisters, you know there were times when your parents lock you in the bathroom and say, you're going to stay in the bathroom until you work it out.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't the two sides forced to just be in the room until they can hammer something? Why are they let go?
Well, there is no one, certainly during that period, that wouldn't have been in the room as long as it took if it was going to prove productive. In fact, we literally negotiated 17 straight days, nights and days, to conclude that strike. But until we got to that point where we were able to make progress and stay in a room, even though it took long, long days and many of them, it didn't make sense. It was counterproductive. I mean, you know, you stand in a room, and at some point, if you don't have anything good to say, you start saying bad things,
all right,
and that becomes counterproductive.
Do you have rooms to go and take a nap in?
One of the things I always make sure is that, since negotiations tend to go around the clock at the end, that I always have a place that I could sneak a few winks. Absolutely.
So if two sides do go out on strike, at some point they need to come back to the table. How does the fact that there was a strike affect their ability to negotiate now?
Well, it's obviously a significant detriment, but both sides know when they go on strike that they're going to have to, at some point, find a resolution. And once again, everybody has their own style. In my case, I always make sure that the doors of communication are open, there's always an ability, hopefully sooner than later, to talk, whether it's back channel or otherwise, to make sure that when the time has come for the parties to have fruitful conversations, that they know it and they can do it sooner than later.
So when you say back channel, in that case, it could be, you know, you call Tom on a cell phone and say, hey, I'm going to happen to be at Denny's at 2:30. Why don't you happen to be there, too, so we can chat a little bit while this craziness is going on?
Certainly that's a possibility. Once again, my style is always to keep the avenues of communication open, and that if there's a dispute, it's a dispute because the parties in good faith have viable, real differences of opinion, and doesn't mean you have to be disagreeable just because you disagree.
Does the lead negotiator on the other side have your cell phone number?
Sure.
Would they call it?
There was a strike in 95 up in Northern California that I settled coming out of a shower in my bathrobe, when I got a call from one of the top officials in a large grocery company. We tentatively made an agreement over the telephone, spent the whole day putting it in writing, and it happened to be the Passover. And, for strategic reasons, I told them that I was going to the Seder, and if they wanted a deal that day so they could open their stores in time for the Easter holiday, they had to bring the papers over to be signed at my Passover Seder. So we called that the Passover Seder settlement.
Turns out you're actually Roman Catholic, but that's a whole other...
Well, that's all part of the bargaining process.
Right. Steve Stemmerman is a partner with the San Francisco law firm of Davis, Cowell & Bow. He was lead negotiator for the UFCW, representing almost 60,000 Southern California supermarket workers in 2004. He's working on a similar situation in Northern California right now. Steve Stemmerman, thanks for talking with us on The Business.
It's been my pleasure.
After a short break, soaps on the bubble. Stick around. It's The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. To the horror of housewives and college students everywhere, NBC executives suggested earlier this year that Days of Our Lives may not survive past the end of its contract in 2009. And this isn't the first time Days, as it's known to its devotees, has been threatened with cancellation. More than ever, all of the once venerable soaps are now vulnerable to TV's Sword of Damocles. Will soaps survive? Stay tuned. My evil twin, the business producer Matt Holtzman, has just awakened from a coma with this stunning tale.
Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives. Days of Our Lives, a new dramatic serial starring MacDonald Carey.
Days of Our Lives leapt from radio to television on November 8, 1965, and began spinning tales of love and lust and heartbreak and intrigue and some more love and lust in the small town of Salem, somewhere in the heart of America.
This hot coffee's going to taste good.
Mm. Thanks, Mrs. Horton.
How long are you going to call me Mrs. Horton?
Well, what would you like me to call you? I can't call you Mother because I've already had one real mother.
Days, along with three of the other 16 soaps that were on the air in 1965, are still on the air, continuing to invent plots so convoluted they'd flummox Rube Goldberg. But let's see you come up with an hour of drama every weekday for 40 years and see if you do better.
Joe Rowling still speeding in. 5, 4, 3.
The production schedule for soaps is grueling. Using the head writer's playbook of stories for the entire season, a small army of scribes cranks out pages and pages of dialogue each week.
We used to do a show a day, and now we're doing 6 shows in 5 days.
Peter Reckel, along with Christian Alfonso, are better known as Beau and Hope Brady of Days of Our Lives.
Fancy face. I promised you a romantic evening at the Penthouse Grill.
You don't want to go, do you?
Well, would you mind?
Are you kidding me? I don't care where we are as long as we're together.
Along with General Hospital's Luke and Laura, they're one of the most beloved couples in daytime TV. But being soap opera royalty means being in almost every story arc, and that adds up to a huge amount of work.
On the weekend, I go through my scripts for that week and get them pretty close to memorizing, and then the night before you really...
Review.
Yeah, really get them down.
I do the same thing.
At one point, both actors escape the grind of daytime by doing stints on nighttime soaps. Peter on Knott's Landing and Christian on Falcon Crest and Melrose Place.
It's much slower paced.
Yeah, they're doing 60 pages in 10 days and we're doing 90 pages in one day.
Maybe 60 pages. Yeah. They'd be like, oh my God, how are we going to get these 4 pages? And I'm like, yeah. I must be joking.
But shows like Falcon Crest were the exception rather than the rule in the 80s and 90s.
Daytime hasn't changed. You know what's changed? Prime time's changed, and features have changed. They're soaps now.
Desperate Housewives, Grey's Anatomy, even Lost, and the reality shows all follow the cliffhanger strategy of the soaps, but they've largely left the melodrama behind, except for comic effect. These shows, along with their bigger budgets and bigger stars, reach more people, and more of the right people, at least where advertisers are concerned. That, and the fact that broadcast TV audiences are slipping overall like sand through the hourglass, has put soaps in a precarious position with the networks. Which is hard to believe, given how important soaps were to their bottom line not so long ago.
You know, for years this was a cash cow that, you know, wouldn't stop mooing. You know, I mean, for decades, you know, the daytime soaps paid for primetime.
Michael Logan covers soaps for TV Guide.
As the World Turns was the monster in the ratings, and that really for almost 20 years was the number one show, and at its peak that alone was pulling in, you know, 15 million, you know, viewers a day, and had at its peak 57% share of the audience. You know, I mean, that kind of numbers are impossible today. Primetime, daytime, anytime.
The joke around the lot at NBC in the 80s was between Days of Our Lives and the Johnny Carson show, we paid the rent.
Ken Corday's parents, Ted and Betty, along with Erna Phillips, created Days of Our Lives in 1964, and he became executive producer in 1985. The symbol of his show, a large hourglass, sits on a table in his comfortable couch-covered office on the NBC lot in Burbank.
So we were a great income stream for the network in the heyday of the show. Not that the show is not as gold as it was then, but there weren't as many how do I say it, alternative programmings to look at. It was three networks and in the daytime and talk shows and soaps.
At the height of their popularity and the height of network TV's reach, a typical soap earned a whopping 10 rating, and they made enough money for everybody. But thanks to cable and all our other modern entertainment options, soaps are lucky to get a 3. To make matters worse, shows that are not owned by the networks make less money for the networks, and by and large, the networks don't own the soaps. Ken Corday still owns the show his parents created in 1965. Procter & Gamble created As the World Turns and Guiding Light in 1956 and 1936, respectively, and they still own both. And though they're making more and more money overseas in Canada, Australia, even Scandinavia and Israel, it's the owners and the distributors that get that money, not the networks. Given this financial equation, if Days and Y&R and General Hospital go off the air during the current writer's strike, it could burst the soap bubble once and for all. TV Guide's Michael Logan.
They learned this with the O.J. Simpson trial when all of the soaps were preempted for several weeks at the height of that trial. And when they came back, a lot of viewers didn't.
During the strike of 1988, executives, non-union writers, and yes, even union guys working on the sly kept working. They wrote dialogue based on story arcs outlined in the head writer's notebook months before.
There were strangenesses you could see. There were, you know, some kind of out-of-nowhere twists and turns and character, revelations that didn't seem right. But, you know, that happens even when the head writers are in charge, you know?
During this current strike, it's reported that some soap writers changed their union status in order to cross the picket line. Even if that's not the case, you could understand why writers would even consider such a move, given the huge stakes this time around. Everybody seems to be aware that it's now or never for the soaps, especially veterans like Day's reigning couple, Christian Alfonso and Peter Reckell.
Yeah, there's a little bit of fear in us. Absolutely. We do not take it for granted that we will be here forever, and that's why we're not afraid to work hard. And we want to work hard. We want to make the show the best it can be.
What's interesting is that the threat of extinction may actually save the soaps. Days of Our Lives, for one, hired a bunch of hot producers away from the number one soap, The Young and the Restless, and the stars seemed thrilled with the renewed energy on the set.
When
but
somebody's
we're getting
looking,
notes, we're being directed for the first time in many years. A little better. Why don't you try this, Christian? Or don't forget about that, Peter. And you know, let's do it. Go one more around and take the time and be creative and make it the best.
In any event, soaps still have some life to live. There are 3.5 million Americans watching daytime drama each week, and some would argue that the ratings actually don't reflect the true numbers, since soaps are often seen in places like college dorms that Nielsen doesn't cover. Soap websites are huge, and reruns are big and getting bigger on the fast-growing SoapNet cable network. For Days of Our Lives, Ken Corday, it's not about technology or the web or streaming or anything else, but about giving the audience what it's always wanted and will always want.
It's about romance, it's about suspense and mystery, and most of all, it's about making them want to watch tomorrow. And I hope they stay tuned.
For The Business, I'm Matt Holzman.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Warnock. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Club Professor Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.